Welcome to What's My Wine Radio. You're listening to WOOL 91.5 FM in Bellows Falls, Vermont. Today, the What's My Wine group is going to be looking at the Mâcon region, a region known for beautiful and complex white wines. And we'll be discussing the grape and the terroir with our friends Joe Canini, Larry Burdick, and Keith Zimmerman, all of whom are aficionados of the grape and students of wine, which we hope will continue in perpetuity. Because we do not put ourselves forward in any way as being experts about wines and winemaking, but we completely appreciate getting together with friends, good food, and opening interesting bottles of wine. So with that, Larry, can you talk to us a little bit about the Mâcon region? This was sort of your idea to explore Mâcon. The little that I know is that this region is near Burgundy. I think it borders Burgundy and Beaujolais. And it's just south and maybe, slightly west of the Jura. And once again, this is a very, very small parcel of land in the grand scheme of things, but known for some remarkable, beautiful white wines.
So the Mâcon is part of Burgundy. It's just north of Beaujolais there. If you go through the Côte Chalonnaise, which is the southern part of Burgundy, you'll come into the Mâcon. And then if you keep going south, you'll go into Beaujolais. So they're considered Burgundy wines. They actually have a very large production. When you say it's a small region, probably it is geographically, but I think they have a ton of production. In the last 15 years, they've been improving the quality of the wine. It used to be known as a vin de soif or a vin de carafe, and you would find them in every cafe in France would sell a cheap glass of Mâcon white wine.
And just to clarify, the vin de carafe, that's just a carafe of wine that's plunked down on the table.
It's for instance,
the house wine.
Local wine.
Local
wine, very local wine.
Which often is
the best.
The best, yeah.
Yeah, often it is. But it was also so affordable that, you know, every cafe in France was able to order a glass at a very affordable price. It seemed to me, I just found them everywhere in the 70s, for instance, and 80s. You know, in Burgundy in general, there's a few lesser known regions in Burgundy that allow you to buy great wines that are super interesting, Burgundian, and at a great price. Up around Chablis, you have the Auxerre region, where you can buy wines like an Erancy. Have you guys heard of Erancy?
Yeah, I have, yeah.
Or a Saint-Brie.
Saint-Brie,
These are very affordable wines. They're not very known, but they've historically been part of Burgundy forever. I believe some people say the renommé of Burgundy began up in that region, just southwest of Chablis. But anyhow, what I'm trying to get at is there's great wines at great prices to be had in Burgundy. If you start in that northern region just near Chablis, then you come down the Côte de Nuit, it's called. Then you have the Côte de Beaune, and then you have the Côte Chalonnaise. Then you come down to Mâcon. Those are all incredibly interesting and delicious wines that don't cost a lot of money.
And when you say that they're, is it appropriate to say that these are wines that are made sort of in the Burgundian style, whatever that might mean, but they're not necessarily priced as a Burgundy, as a white Burgundy would be? Is that way of saying it?
I think you could say that, yeah. For instance, the Côte Chalonnaise Mâcon, they're Chardonnays.
Pinot Noir and Gamay.
Pinot Noir, Gamay, and Chardonnay, that's it.
That's it.
Yeah.
Those are the three grapes
all the way
that we're talking
from
about.
From far north in Chablis to the far south of Mâcon.
I mean, Saint-Brie is the exception because there's Sauvignon Blanc there, but...
Yeah.
There's a couple exceptions in that area southwest of Chablis, but it's still considered Burgundy.
Yep.
But I guess what I'm saying is, so Mâcon is in that category of great wines you can find that have great gastronomic value for the money.
And through history, I think that's been the case, right? I think throughout the little bit of history on this is that the Dukes of Burgundy were all housed in Dijon, which is at the far north. I mean, Chablis is a little bit further to the north and the west. It kind of sits by itself. Amazing wines there. But the Dukes of Burgundy were in Dijon, and Mâcon was all the way in the south of their kingdom, and they kind of didn't pay that much attention to it. Some of those areas that Larry mentioned, Côte de Nuit, Côte de Beaune, together those are called the Côte d'Or, the Gold Coast. Mm-hmm. And, yes. And those were proximate to Dijon. And that's where the investment, I think, went. And that's where he was really paying attention to the prices of the wine, because that all accrued to the kingdom at some point through taxes or duties or whatever. And the Mâconnais, all the way down in the south, were wines that were left to the people who were growing them. And oftentimes the yields were very high because they were just having the wines for themselves. It wasn't so much an export market for them at that point in time. Mâcon then, after the revolution, all those vines went back to the people, north and south. The Duke didn't have anything to do with it anymore. But the Mâconnais kind of really took possession of their own future at that point in time. Mâcon became a big trading center for the wines, and I think the economics of everything got better in the south. But the wines themselves are beautiful based on the same grapes as the super expensive in a relative basis wines to their north. There's maybe a little less nuance, a little less greatness, but at the same time, they're beautiful wines. They're beautiful
and
drinking
beautiful
every day.
Beautiful with food.
There's no doubt about that. Yeah.
You had made a point earlier, Joe, about how a lot of these wines, that these wine regions, they're named for the prime city that has become the commercial hub, the trading hub throughout history.
I think so, yeah.
So the Bordeaux region, for example, the Burgundy, well, maybe not the Burgundy, but
Mâcon, for sure, because I think Mâcon is the only village in this whole area that doesn't have any grapes around it. It was on the water. It's on the river. All the Mâcon is, as Larry mentioned, it's south, and it's south of the river Saône, I think it's pronounced.
Yes, S-O-N-N-E.
And that would have been the waterway that would have, been the grease to the skids of the money.
Right, yeah, it flows into the Rhone River.
Yeah, and they go south. They could go... continue. There were canals at that point in time. There were more ways to get their wine to the market, and they were not blocked by anybody from doing it. You know, there were not any artificial barriers put up to it, so it thrived.
So, Keith, can you talk a little bit about the characteristics of those three grapes that you talked about, that you mentioned as being the primary, sort of the backbone of this region?
It's hard to say. I mean, the Chardonnay is the white grape of the Burgundy, with a little bit of Alagote. Alagote is a little, what would you say, Larry? It's a little more acidic. It's not quite as...
leaner.
Leaner, yeah. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have the same...
That's a good adjective, yeah.
...forwardness of the fruit.
Leaner is perfect.
But in the Burgundy, the Chardonnay, it's not really a fair comparison to California, where the wines are very tropical fruits kind of flavor. The wines coming out of Burgundy tend to be minerally, have a mineral characteristic.
Which
to
I
them.
Love. I happen to love that.
And then in the Mâcon, it's warmer than up in the northern part of Burgundy. So the wines are a little fleshier, a little more fruit forward there. And from what I know, the Pinot Noir is a red grape, and the Gamay is a red grape. So those don't play a very big part in the wine production in the Mâcon, a little bit, but not too much. So it's I don't know what the percentage is, but I'm guessing it's 90% white and maybe 10%.
I think the Dukes of Burgundy had a big interest in making sure that Gamay, which was a very prolific grower, very very prolific grower, had an interest in not letting Gamay go northward into Pinot Noir, because that was where their real bread and butter was on the Côte d'Or. So Gamay, I think, has become an amazing grape as it's been tamed back. And some of it, I think, has been replaced by Chardonnay, just in terms of what can be sold and what people are having. You go further south into Beaujolais, you get a great expression of, of Gamay that has really stood the test of time in many ways.
So we have five wines that we're going to be tasting. This first one is Cave de Lugny, La Côte Blanche, and it's an unoaked Chardonnay, very, very reasonably priced white wine and sort of like a workhorse wine. You could serve this with a lot of different types of food.
Wine, as Larry said before, great bistro wine.
Yeah, bistro wine. And this is 13% alcohol. And one reason why we mention the alcohol level is because it really influences the overall taste and character of the wine. Wines that are high in alcohol tend to be heavier, more fruit forward, and the leaner wines tend to be less alcohol heavy. And it influences the flavor quite a bit. And I find that over time, I become more and more sensitive to that or aware of that as I taste different wines. Anyway, so here we are with the 100% Chardonnay. And Larry, can we just ask you, you were the one who introduced this idea of looking at the Mâcon region. How are you experiencing this wine?
I find the alcohol not being quite integrated. I'm not sure why. It does have at the end that characteristic Mâcon flavor, but I'm not enjoying it immensely. Let me take another smell and taste.
I think that alcohol point is super interesting.
It has nothing to do with what Cynthia was saying about the amount of alcohol in the wine. It's how the wine is, how the flavors are integrated.
But how does that happen, Keith, from the vintner's perspective? What's going on?
That I don't know. I don't know how to answer that.
I mean, this wine would fall into the close to the like more mass-produced wine.
I think that's probably part of it.
And I don't know what they're allowed to do here, but in some cases, wines are, the alcohol is boosted in wine by adding a little chapelization sugar, really. And I don't know if that's the case here, but it wouldn't surprise me. I see this as, if I had a breast of chicken with a little sauce on it, I'd enjoy this wine. By itself, I agree, it's kind of...
It's a little flat.
A little disappointing, but I think it'd be perfectly fine.
But one could cook with this. One could use this and, you know,
cooking
with a risotto or...
I hesitate to be critical because whoever made this wine probably worked hard at it. So, but there's some other flavors going on that I am not liking that aren't integrated also into an overall flavor that I would like to see. But that's just me. I don't know a lot about wine.
I agree with you, Larry, though. I think Joe's points well. This is a big producer. Mm-hmm. I don't think the same care, and maybe that's not the way to say it. I'm sure they're careful with their wines, but it's... You know, a small producer, really, the reputation is all about his name on the label or her name on the label. And in this case, this is a big big producer.
Well, so. Certainly it is a big enterprise. And
I know there's, is that the wine that's marked, the Lugny.
Yes.
Cave de Lugny. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I know there's some very good wines that have the Lugny name on them somewhere. So I wouldn't be...
And they may.
I wouldn't shy away from a Lugny in the future.
Of course, this
producer does have a Mâcon Lugny, which is the town, which is the region.
Right.
Lugny is the
I've
region.
I've tasted that. Yeah,
It may be very good.
The Cave de Lugny might be where the juice is fermented from a lot of other places. You know, have produced
like
a bunch.
Cooperative.
I mean, that's probably a great way to describe this, because I bet you that's how it's made, and grapes coming from various vineyards, not necessarily from the village of Mâcon Lugny.
Right. In fact, they say on the label that it's closer to the village of Chardonnay.
Oh, so it'd be further north.
Also, that's probably being bottled under other labels also in other places. What do we know?
Is this a wine that will taste differently tomorrow, or is this kind of it?
I think this is it.
Mm. Well, so Joe, what is the next bottle that we have there? It's the next in line. So also, it's a Mâcon Village.
Now we're going to Mâcon Village, which is a step up certainly from the village, from the Mâcon itself, right? Village, and this is from a négociant that would be pretty familiar to anyone who's been a wine shop, Louis Jadot, who we talked about before, is an amazing. Negociant based in Beaune, France. So his first love is Burgundy. So he represents, as a Negociant, lots of smaller producers, buys production, bottles it on, under his labeling. And I think as large Negociants go, he's very well distributed all throughout the United States. It's hard to go wrong with a Jadot wine. It really is. They're very consistent. There's a stylistic, but let's see what we have here.
While we do this next tasting, I just want to remind everyone that you're listening to WOOL 91.5 FM radio in Bellows Falls. And the program today is all about the region called Mâcon in France. And we're tasting a flight of five different wines made in the Mâcon region, featuring primarily the Chardonnay grape. So we've tried one, and then in this second one that is the Mâcon Village, Joe, tell us again why the including the name village or village on the label actually is an indicator of a step up.
My understanding is the village wines, first of all, would have more of a terroir-specific identity, but oftentimes the villages are on slightly higher ground, and the land below them would be a little lesser quality wines, still good, but lesser quality as you get into the village. Much like you in the Cru Beaujolais, you're working your way in altitude. And so I think in quality can change, but more importantly, I think you can recognize certain villages when you've had them before. This one is, I think, a more Mâcon village. It could be from any of the villages. And it probably is. It might be blended. But my first taste in the glass, I found a significant difference between the first wine.
Significant.
And this one. And I'm quite enjoying this one, actually.
It says that this particular wine is made without oak contact to maximize its vibrant flavor. So the oak would have sort of tamped it down a little bit with the tannic contribution. Is that what they're...
It would have added different things to it, for sure. And you know, the great point about that is the first one was stainless steel. This one is stainless steel, no oak. So it's interesting how different they are with the same vinification going on.
So again, this is 13% alcohol as well. And
a little lower,
yeah,
right, than the last one.
Same, I think, year. Last one was, were these the same year?
This is the second one's 23. The village is 23. And what year is that first one? Is also 23?
22.
22, okay. Yeah. And they're both 13% alcohol.
Oh, both,
but
13,
I'm finding that the Mâcon Village, it has these bright, bright notes, like green apple notes. And but that's not the overarching thing. There's structure to this wine, and there's a beautiful middle tone to it, which
is good.
Yeah, it's quite lovely. Keith, what are you tasting?
Oh, I'm with you. The first one didn't. So Larry says it's not integrated to my taste. I'm to Larry's as well. This one's really is a nice, it's a good drink, you know. Getting into the details of the tasting, it's a bit, you know, so personal in many respects. And, you know, I just think this wine would be fine to drink without food. It'd be nice to have a little something to eat with it, but it would go great with any meal you might want to have. So
I'm thinking roast chicken. Would be really amazing with roasted potatoes, and that would be just killer.
Yeah, I agree. It's a food. It's a very correct wine, and we should be having it with food. It'd be great.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm thinking like a pork tenderloin with lemon.
Also could be good. Yeah, because there is a little
that citrus.
Underlying citrus note here, which is really sweet, very nice, almost like a tangerine. Mm.
But it has enough body that it can really... It could stand up to something a little bit more substantial.
That's a big difference, right? The mouthfeel of this one is so different than the first one, which was very 1 minute. It's there and then it's gone. And this one has something that cerebral.
Well, it's lingering. You know, it's still on the palate. So that's an indicator that there's, you know, there's what I keep referring to as some structure to the wine. I don't know if that's even a correct word to use, but that's what occurs to me, you know, as I'm tasting it.
It's correct. I've had it enough that, you know, to me, this Mâcon Village from Louis Jadot is typical of what Mâcon Village is on this level of production. You know, we're going to taste another wine that might be totally different. That's also a Mâcon Village. In terms of quality, it might be very different. But it's got that classic Mâcon taste. You know, Louis Jadot, We said this earlier, that they have simple and correct wines, and then they have some wines that are great and everything in between. That they just have their hands into so many different types of production. So this is a food-friendly, tastes like Mâcon, balanced wine with some citrus notes, like you noted, and Keith.
I would just think, like, if I went into a bistro, the first wine would be probably the one that would be the inexpensive glass of Vin Blanc that you have standing up at the bar on the way somewhere else. And the second one would be one where you're sitting down at a table
and starting to get serious.
And the juices are running, and you're really, maybe we can do something with this one.
Joe, that's
food.
That's great that you said that.
But I'm also appreciating what, you know, the comment about some of these wines.
That would be at Carrefour on the motorway.
On the motorway. At 9 in the morning, the truck driver stopping for the Vin Blanc, the Vin Rouge.
Oh, man.
You know, it's interesting, just talking about price. I forget what the price was on this bottle, but when I had a house in Coucy and Morvan, which is on the edge of Burgundy, I brought a gift to my neighbor of a Mâcon village, and he asked me what I had spent on it. It was 16 euros. It was a real good one. He was shocked. He never bought Mâcons for more than 10 euros. He was like, what? You spent that much on a bottle of Mâcon? And I had the same reaction from another person in Dijon when I had spent 12 euros on a Mâcon. And he's like, what? You spent that much money on a Mâcon? Just to give you the idea psychologically.
It's the people's wine.
It's the people's
wine.
They
feel like they own it and they work it. And that's always been, through history, I think that's been the case. So
until recently, there were no premier cru. There are no grand cru.
Right.
And there are no, they're just recently, I think maybe, was it this year? This year they're bottling some, or they're possibly selling.
I think it's before this year, but I forget when, Keith. But it's recent.
But it's been recent, yeah.
Yeah. But that gets back to also the notion that winemakers had a realization that they could just up their game a little by being more careful in the winemaking, or separating themselves out from the cooperative and then, you know, giving extra care to their production. So Mâcon is one of those regions that's improving a lot still, and has been for the last 10 years at least.
And I think so much less wine is going to cooperatives, and so many small family holdings have now found a way.
Yeah.
Well, it's
some
that
way
emphasis
to bottle
on
their own wine.
Yeah.
The last two generations have said, I'm going to make my own wine
exactly,
and get more money for
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
And
right.
do something special on
yeah.
top of it all.
Yeah.
Forgive me, Cynthia.
No, it was just to make a point about this, everything, the trend towards the artisanal and things that
That's
are really
right.
crafted.
That's what it is.
And that was something that struck me about your comment, Larry, about Louis Jadot. I look at that label and I think, oh, that, you know, it's a huge producer. And my default is to want to find the more unique bottle, the you know, something from a smaller producer, an artisanal producer. Mm-hmm. But this is testament that, you know, this particular wine, this Mâcon Village from Louis Jadot, it's really, it's lovely and it's holding up in the glass. And
it's a good value for,
and it's
for,
a good value
for what it is.
Yeah, it's a very, very good value.
Pay.
Yes, yeah. Well, and so then we have for the next bottle, I think this is also a Mâcon.
Mâcon Village.
A Mâcon Village, yeah. The Domaine Corsin.
2023.
Yes, and the one that we just tasted was also 2023. So this is almost like a side-by-side comparison, except Louis Jadot, big producer, and this wine would be perhaps
from a
smaller family producer. And I'm just
the
gonna
nose
check.
Is just, I mean, this just, this just jumps out of the glass at you. And this, the okay. nose to me is just.
I don't know anything about the producer, but this is probably someone who decided not to be part of a co-op at some part of his family's history and decided to make wine to be bottled by themselves.
Clean. And I would say this is like so clean.
Clean mouthfeel is just, they get a little unctuous and.
Beautiful.
Boy, the nose is just beautiful, isn't it? There's so much information there, and it's so pleasing, so pleasing. It's lovely.
I think, Larry, you and I have probably had six, seven, eight vintages of this wine. I mean, I have over the years of this particular wine. And
it never disappoints. First time. Believe it or not, yeah.
Well, Corsin also makes wine in Saint-Vrain. So they...
Oh, maybe I have.
Yeah, you've had the Saint-Vrain, I think.
I think so.
So really good winemaking. Paying attention there. Again, their production is not gigantic. It would be more like the Mary Taylor Co. or, you know, just sort of that negotiation, small properties that they're trying to help to get to a market. And
Joe,
is this a negotiation too, Joe?
I think Corsin is.
Corsin's because they have Saint-Vrain,
or they own, or it's a family that owns several properties in several villages. That could also be the case, and they just bought a, like the Mary Taylor ones. He had vintages and vineyards in two separate spots in Cahors and.
So what is the other wine that you're mentioning that is made by Corsin?
Saint-Vrain, which is another village.
So it's Saint-Vrain,
V-E-R-A-N. Mm-hmm. And it's a separate village.
And also the same grape village. Or no?
Also the same grape, Chardonnay.
Uh-huh. The different growing conditions.
Just a different village, different terroir. It's quite, I mean, I think as I recall, the Saint-Vrain was maybe a little bit more linear with more of an acidic ending. But again, these wines are phenomenal.
This is also in the Mâcon.
Also in the Mâcon,
so it's a village. It's a village in the Mâcon. So it could be labeled Mâcon. So you know,
it's a like a sub appellation. You know, it's like Saint-Vrain is a grouping, Mâcon is a grouping, and so they are. Saint-Vrain is a smaller area than Mâcon Village would be.
Yeah.
And it's further to the south, and it actually borders Beaujolais.
Okay, but it is in the Mâcon
region. It is in the Mâcon, yeah.
Yeah, so it's just one of the specific villages
correct.
Within Mâcon.
And as you get named specific villages, I think the control and possibly the quality is better.
Which we'll be moving to some village, some specific villages next.
I think I read that the Saint-Vrain is the most recent appellation to get the nomination of
1971, I think.
I find the Saint-Vrains, we'll talk about it again later, I guess, to have this floral quality that is very unique
pretty
in Mâcon. Yeah. And I just love that.
Worthy. Very nice.
The mouthfeel in this wine is wonderful. There's almost a sweetness, but it's perfectly balanced out by the other fruit and acidity flavors. So even though you notice the sweetness, you don't have any thought that, oh, this is a sweet wine. You know, it's. I don't know if you guys would agree with that.
No, I'm totally with you.
I think it's a little riper fruit taste.
That's the word I'm looking for.
But what is that? It's not an astringent quality that's balancing it out. It's that, and it's not quite mineral either. I don't quite know how to describe it. So the fruit is really balanced beautifully with something else that's... creating a nice nuance to this wine.
I get minerals. I get almost like slate rocks. Again, that doesn't sound very attractive, does it? But and that's what Chablis far to the north would be described. Many people who taste it as like flinty. But it's interesting that this much further south, it has similar characteristics.
I think it does too. I mean, you know, it's got that front taste of the bit riper fruit, apple-y kind of thing, that finishes with that nice mineral characteristic.
I don't know what 23 was versus 22 in terms of years, but the Village is 22. This one's 23. This could be just a warmer summer. You know, just riper fruit, as you say, and that will lead to those more fresh fruit.
Bowing to Mother Nature.
Almost going to the tropical realm.
Well, so we'll take just one moment to remind everybody that we're listening to What's My Wine with Keith Zimmerman, Larry Burdick, and Joe Canini, and myself, Cynthia Reeves. The topic that we're looking at in today's episode concerns the Mâcon region in France. Beautiful, beautiful countryside adjacent to the Burgundy region, and we're looking at a flight of wines that are mainly comprised of the Chardonnay grape. And Keith, remind me again, the other two grapes that are predominant are?
They're red, both of them are red grapes.
Oh,
I see. It's Pinot Noir.
And then
the Gamay. I don't know about Aligoté in the Macon.
It's there.
Is it there?
Yeah.
So then the other white grape would be Aligoté.
I think something like 11% or something like that of the production would be Aligoté.
So we just did a program on the Cahors, and those wines, we tasted wines over a 20-year span. We've had three wines now, and they're 2023 and 2022. So let's talk a little bit about why white wines typically are not aged maybe as much as some of the other wines, the red grape wines. Is there anything that one could deduce from this, or is there a fragility to this grape that means that it should be consumed without a lot of age on it typically?
I think the only stab I'll take at that is that I think so far most of the wines we've had have been predominantly stainless steel. I could be wrong on the last one, but I think that's stainless steel as well. And as wood is introduced and great vinification and great fruit, the potential to age white wines is quite amazing, but that's not what these wines are intended for. They're intended for early consumption when they're at their freshest, I think.
Well, this one is highly drinkable. It's really, really delightful. Really nice.
What do you think about that whole aging of whites?
I think most winemakers are making the whites to be consumed early. It's their decision. There's certainly exceptions to that rule. There's some Burgundian wines. I don't know about the Macon specifically, but there's certainly Burgundian wines that can last age well for 10, 15 years.
Yeah.
Other parts of France, Hermitage whites can have the long aging capability. Riesling in Germany can age
like
a long time.
It's like it's a linear sort of relationship, price point and aging potential. I mean, it must be said that some of the wines in the Côte d'Or, the white wines, et cetera, are astronomical in price, and those are the ones that will age. I haven't had a chance to taste many of those for the obvious reason, right? But if you do get a chance, it's quite a sublime experience, or it can be. It can also be a disappointing experience, because wine
spent
is
that much
wine.
Money on that one.
Yeah, exactly. But what we're talking about and what we have talked about all through this program is approachable wines, both in terms of
price point.
The palate and the price point.
Yeah.
And I think that's...
Because they are there. They're out there.
A comment that's really coming from ignorance. I don't know scientifically at all if what I'm saying makes sense, but I think red wines have certain things going on in them that white wines don't have that allow them maybe to more frequently be aged longer. And now I just speak as someone who drinks wines. I have no idea about winemaking or the chemistry of it all. But the oldest wine I ever drank was a Riesling, a white wine from Alsace, which was remarkable.
And what age did it have on it? Do you remember? Or?
I think it had 40 years on it, and it was just a remarkable...
Was it dry or off dry?
It was almost off dry, Joe. I'm trying to remember the exact wine, but... You would think maybe it wasn't a super dry wine, but it was just under the super dry sugar content level, I guess I would say. And once again, I speak now as someone who drinks wines, but maybe red wines have a lot other things going on in them that white wines don't have.
A lot more
possible?
Skin contact, a lot more
skin
a lot
contact,
more
tannin.
Tannins are a big
preservative. And then the whites, it is. That's a good question, Joe, about the sugar. Because it's the acidity and the sugar that help the white wines
to live
a long time.
Yeah, the super dry ones tend to oxidize off if they're with too much time.
Mm-hmm.
And when we say dry and off dry, just, dry is a vinified till basically... All the sugars are vinified out, and what's left is alcohol, and it's in some percentage as volume. Sometimes it's as low as 11 or 12, and sometimes it's as high as 14.5 or 15, which is really borders on almost the port, which port is 16.5 for fortified wine. But off dry would be a descriptor that would say There's a little bit more residual sweetness in this wine. Yeah. A little bit more residual sweetness. And if the wine has acidity to start, it's a magical balance. You've got the acidity of the wine, the sugars to keep it fresh and alive, but you then have years of bottle age that bring nuance of amazing complexity.
Well, I like the way that you phrase that, that it seems to me that the sugars should be in service of the wine, not the leading edge of the wine. The sugars are there to like create kind of like the backbone. Mm-hmm. And
the sugar really is there to create a stable wine. So the yeast is fermenting to, it varies a little bit if, depending on the acidity, but in general, you're trying to get a stable product. I mean, if you look back historically, so
for shipping and everything
for
else.
So you want to have the kind of the minimum 18 to 19% sugar in the grape before you ferment it. It's better if you can get something in the 21 to 23 or 4
Is that what they talk
range.
About when people say bricks?
Yeah,
is that that's what you're talking
that's
about?
What okay. Bricks. Okay. So you want to, you know, if you have something in the 21 range, then, you know, that's going to ferment, be a nice stable wine. And then it's everything else that you're going to do with it. But the sugar content, that's what's
interesting.
That's
so the, and the acidity provides kind of almost the backdrop to that sugar.
And the volatiles are the...
Whatever comes from the wood,
tannins
whatever comes from
and,
the grape.
Yeah. So interesting. Yeah, Larry.
But the other very old white wines I remember having were from Vouvray in the Loire Valley. Very old.
Chenin Blanc.
Yes, Chenin Blanc.
Is the grape there?
Is the grape, yeah.
And they all, again, were off dry. They were
then big bricks to start.
Or even a little sweeter. And they seemed to age wonderfully to me. But I didn't know much about them at the time as I tasted them. But I remember thinking, wow.
Pretty amazing wines.
And they were very old. And they had deep color.
Yeah, almost like tawny, like towards the caramel color, right? I mean, some of them.
Not quite.
Not so much?
But a deep gold, deep golden color with the yellow.
Nice.
The yellow gold, not the white gold. Yeah.
So the Mâcon, this region is adjacent to Burgundy. And there are some white Burgundies that can be cellared for a very long time. And those are wines that I always equate with a kind of a buttery quality to them. They can be so fulsome. And this Mâcon wine is decidedly different in characteristic, and it's their shoulder to shoulder in terms of the terroir. The next wine that we're going to taste, it's actually the, it's also, I believe it's all Chardonnay, it's Viret Classé. And this is a 13.5% alcohol. The first three were just 13. So maybe a little bit stronger, a little bit more. A wine with a little bit more fortitude. And it's a 2022. So these are still all within the same, you know, almost 12-month period in terms of their aging. This is the fourth
one.
And the fifth will be the Puy Fuissé.
This is pretty nice.
That's good.
I mean, the one thing I'm getting here on first approach that I didn't get in any of the other ones is a little bit of salinity. You know, a little salt, almost like a vague saltiness to it.
I agree, and it's welcome.
Very attractive. That could be coming just from more limestone. I'm not sure what it's coming from, but and very cliche, I think, is a village named of two villages that used to be separate. Right, Keith, is that
that's
what you
correct.
Remember?
That's my understanding.
Yeah.
I'm not a historian of that area or that knowledgeable, but that's what I understand.
So Viret, the village of Viret
and
Classé.
They're next to one another or very close. And
also pretty far south in the Mâcon. Again, close to the Beaujolais.
And the way that these words are spelled, it's sometimes helpful to hear it's V-I-R-E. Is the name of one village, and then Classé, Classé is the second. And this vintner is André Bonhomme.
What a nice name.
Yes.
André Goodman.
Goodman.
It's a beautiful name.
Man.
I'm going to change my name to Bonhomme.
Bonhomme. Wow. Yeah, this is lovely and very, very different in character than the prior wine.
I would describe this wine and in relation to the other ones, is the most pretty wine we've had so far. Very, very feminine. It's not a one that's attacking. It's very subtle, but it's, again, I think it's really well balanced. It's a good producer. I've had this one before, too.
Yeah, it's just this lovely sweetness around the edges. Yeah.
It's kind of
elegant. It kind of balances everything out. It's just beautiful.
Elegant, yeah. That'd be good. Really superb food wine. I could see seafood with this.
Salinity in the background is great.
Can anyone say Coquille Saint-Jacques? Like a beautiful scallop with this.
Scallop dish.
Man, that would be really good.
Yes, yeah.
Say that 3 times faster.
So what are the foods from the Mâcon? You know,
Bresse is just to the west. So Poulet de Bresse is a very, very famous chicken that is renowned all over France. So when I said roast chicken, I said that with purpose, because that's what I want to have with this. That's exactly what I want to have.
It would still
be
good. I mean, roast chicken would be delicious with this.
Even
the scallops would be great.
A little white wine sauce, anything you want to do with it. Some beautiful vegetables.
The charcuterie they're famous for the charcuterie in that region, I can say.
Freshwater fish,
pork,
do you think?
Charcuterie.
What do you think about freshwater fish? What do you think about like a canal or something like that of brochet?
I think that would work good.
Or sole, from the sea maybe, but freshwater fish.
Yeah.
Trout would be good.
Yeah, it would be
great. You know, there's some soft cow cheeses from that area that are well known that go with this wine. I forget if the Marcellin is from that area, but it might be.
But I can understand why the Marcellin would come to mind, because cheese with this wine, I think, would be just beautiful, just totally beautiful.
Again, and that's something to be noted, too. I think once you get into the Mâconnais area, there are some elevation changes and there are some hills, and the vines tend to take advantage of that. But beyond that, it's mixed agriculture through this area. I mean, crops, dairy. So there's lots going on. Animal husbandry.
Yeah, I think
there's
the Charolais is from that area.
Which is a very famous beef breed.
Big,
gray-white beasts that are quite amazing. But the Charolais beef is famous all through France, for sure.
Well, and I keep coming back to the fact that here we are once again talking about, like with Cahors, what is a relatively small plot of land in the grand scheme of things. And here is, I mean, we've tasted 4 expressions of the grape from this small area, and the differences among them are really quite extraordinary.
Yeah, and this goes back, as you mentioned in the Cahors, when we discussed Cahors, that the Celts or Celts established the villages or whatever.
Yes.
And the same in this area, in the Mâcon, it was the Celts first, and then the Romans came up. And
then the church.
The churches came and plotted out all the properties.
And then the revolution.
And then the revolution, and that happened. That was a big one. In terms of this region, that was a really big one, I think.
Yeah, but the churches owned all the vineyards for the longest period of time. I mean, everything was in service to the church. So,
and I don't think World War II, it seems to me that, I'm trying to remember, I think the Germans did enter the Mâcon. But for the most part, that was kind that was kind of the
southern delineation, Vichy probably Vichy, government.
Yeah.
You don't know them
exactly.
There too.
Yeah,
aren't the cheeses from Citeaux in the area of Cluny? I think that's in the Mâcon.
It is.
Yes. Yeah. Excellent cheeses. Yeah. Beautiful. Well, so we have one other and perhaps a grand wine to taste. And Larry, tell us why the Puy-Fouissé is sort of taking a little bit of a left turn from the Mâcon and Mâcon village.
I'm not sure I know, but I'll tell you what I think. But this last comment on the very classé, it's very elegant. And as we taste it, it's all those aromas and flavors are becoming more integrated into a single impression, at least for me.
That's a nice way to put it. That's great.
Pretty enjoyable.
Yeah. Very, just lovely.
It's lovely, yeah, and it really is.
And it's worth noting, so we talked at some length about the Louis Jadot Mâcon village. Now we have a Puy Fouissé. This is also offered through Louis Jadot, and it's a 2022, so we're still right in that 12-month period in terms of the age of the wine. And this is 100% Chardonnay.
It's definitely Macon. It's right down near Beaujolais.
It's right down all the way down on the southwestern corner of the Macon. It's adjacent to Saint-Vérin, what we just we had tasted earlier. So
Should we bring up, and I don't know much about it, but should we bring up malolactic fermentation?
I was going to ask Keith about
that. Should we bring that
actually
up?
I think that's an interesting.
Does anyone
thing to
understand
bring
how or know
I think
how
Keith
to explain?
Would be the only one, but.
It's
I
not
mean,
an
people,
easy thing to
it's
describe.
It's not, no, but
now we're diving deep. We're getting pretty deep.
But it is.
We might have to do that on a later show.
It may not be easy to describe, but I think it's easy to detect in a wine.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you have a wine that's really, really acidic and it's just kind of puckering your mouth, the bacteria that winemakers will use, and they'll put the wine through what's called a malolactic fermentation, and that softens it changes the acidity. Like the wines that were in the stainless steel, I doubt they went through malolactic.
They didn't, I don't think.
It's possible, but it's doubtful. These wines from the village, or from the specific villages, the Puy-Vissé.
And the Saint-Vérin, the Viry-Clissé.
Feels like the acidity has been left alone to me.
Yeah, I agree. When I taste a wine, in addition to everything else, the end thing is this sort of yeasted bread taste. To me, I'm like, that wine has gone through a malolactic fermentation. Because it does, the acidity goes down, and there's something about the yeast that's been introduced or whatever was there, present. It happens sometimes in the bottle, sometimes in a barrel, right?
Preferably in the barrel.
Preferably because it can be an explosion of the bottle.
Yeah, or it can turn it cloudy.
You can see things problematic. Because it's an introduction of yeast and they eat things. Yeah. It's always pretty distinctive.
It's the bacteria.
So it's a secondary process.
The wine has gone through all its fermentation.
Yeah.
It's
the fruit has done what it can do.
It's done fermenting. Mm-hmm. The sugar has been consumed by the yeast. And now the winemaker is deciding, well, I feel like this acidity is too sharp and I want to soften it a bit.
Do you think the more important read expensive a wine is, it's more likely, especially in a white, to have undergone a malolactic fermentation or not necessarily?
I don't think necessarily. Yeah, I think it really depends on
where's
acid?
The wine? Where are we going?
Yeah, where's the acid?
But that kind of decision would be made as the vintner is tasting the wine.
Yeah, I mean that's what I think.
You can
do the analysis. I mean, there's certainly
chemical analysis.
You know,
there's a lot of
lab work in winemaking today. They want to be able to ship a stable wine, right? So, you know, they need to have some information so they can make sure that the wine is stable in the bottle.
And ideally they'd want the consumer upon tasting to be able to recognize this is this producer's wine. So they try to make their wines recognizable over time. It doesn't mean they're the same every year, but there's a stamp on it. And I find especially with wines up the price point a little bit, otherwise if they don't think they're going to come up with a wine that's representative of their terroir, they won't bottle it.
They won't bottle it, no.
They'll sell it off.
Most won't, many won't. And then they would sell that off in bulk.
To a cooperative.
Or to someone else, a négociant.
That would blend it with other people that weren't, you know, decided that they didn't want to put their name on that wine. It was a challenging vintage or whatever.
They cover their cost for that year. They try to.
It's a testament to these small producers. I mean, if anyone ever has the ability to go and visit some of these small winemakers in the countryside in France or Italy or wherever, it is eye-opening.
It'll be one of the most interesting things you'll ever do. Yeah,
it is. It's so interesting, and it is a work of the hand as well as the heart and taste. And it just takes, it's an all-year-long process, even though the harvest is in September or, you know.
I think we didn't talk about it in this show, but in the Cahors show, you know, we discussed plots of land that have been in families for generations. But even in the ones that haven't been in generations, many people in those areas have grown up around the wine trade. So maybe they worked a summer or they walked out in the vineyard and they tasted the grapes as they were ripening.
Yep.
And they've learned a lot just by being with their grandmother and their grandfather and their uncle and their aunt.
And then their uncle died and it was theirs. And it was theirs. Like, let's be winemakers. And I think there's a lot of that, actually. It's a good generational movement throughout Europe in winemaking and here, too.
Yes,
it's happening here, but we just don't have the same
longevity in years. Yeah. Experience.
But I think in France, it's hobbled by the fact that by law, as a plot of land is passed down from generation to generation, it has to be divided equally among the heirs. And so plots of land get fractured and divided off into smaller and smaller plots.
I think in Burgundy, that's been particularly the case, or in the Macon region we're talking
recalling,
about. Where
a lot of small holdings.
A lot of small holders. Versus Bordeaux, where they're owned by larger conglomerates or whatever. So
we have this Puy Fuissé. Larry, did you have a chance to taste that? Or?
I did.
Yes?
I just wanted to make a comment. We should have a show of answering technical questions, maybe.
That would be great.
Wouldn't that be
nice? I'd love that, Mm-hmm. Like, Keith, you used the term oenologist, which is, you know, everybody in the wine world knows that term, but, you know, people may not.
Oenologist is a wine scientist.
Fantastic.
And it's a large expense to a winemaker to have the oenologist come in and help them make their wine.
The big producers will have an oenologist on staff. The smaller producers would contract. Like the bottling lines, you know, the big producers will have their own bottling line, and the small producers will hire somebody that rolls in on a truck and bottles their juice.
And it's really cool. That's what I love to see. I look at these domaines. I think it was one of the Cahors thing, and it's a picture of them. And what you saw out back were very large pallets after pallet after pallet wrapped up all in plastic. And what they were bottles waiting for the bottling truck to come.
Empty
bottles. Waiting for the bottling truck to come. Bottle the wine, and they'll label sometimes at the same exact time. And that's all under contract. It's subcontracting for bottling. That's what you're doing. If you're family and you have four properties in different places, you might vinify them all in one place just because that's where the bottling guy is coming, and you'll label them differently as appropriate.
I was with Larry in the Burgundian area, and I think we're Von Romane, Larry, and Guillaume's. Guillaume Tardy was the winemaker, and we were in his cellar, and he was trying to determine which bottle he was going to bottle that year. Remember that, Larry? And he was, you know, the shape of the bottle was just, it was the Burgundian shape with the sloped shoulders. But, he was just trying to determine what the glass was going to be that this year on how he was going to label. And that's quite an expense for these winemakers. I mean, labels and capsules
expensive.
Are not, they're not cheap.
Well, and it's also, it's their face to the world. It's their marketing.
It's their face to the world.
That whole label.
Keith, that's the year he was changing his label.
The shape of the bottle and the label were kind of integrated there, what he was going to do. Did he end up having a Burgundian, like a more bone, like, because there's a slight differences north to south in how these things are bottle shapes.
You know, Guillaume's wines are the only wines I could offer a vertical tasting in because I get six bottles every year. They're slowly piling up in my cellar.
Good. I'm available.
I think that could be a show.
Yeah.
And Guillaume.
He has lands in maybe six or seven of the most important appellations in Burgundy, including Echezo and Von Romane. And I have to say, he has a Fils-Saint. Well, everyone's going to think this is a show by Francophiles. We better slow down a little, maybe.
We haven't got to Italy yet. Willamette Valley.
Yeah.
And, yes, exactly. Argentina.
The funny thing, and I'll just one little comment in it, but the funny thing to me about Guillaume Tardy was Guillaume will drink these wines from Von Romane with a McDonald's Big Mac. And, you think of having these wines with some very, very
elaborate,
very elaborate meal.
Yeah, right. Something like that.
But he does that to get a rise out of people. Like Echezo also, he'll drink his Echezos with
That's just kind of painful, actually.
It's interesting. I had a wonderful friend and mentor years ago who was quite a wine lover and a great cook and stuff. I mean, we were working together and we were working long hours and we'd see each other after leaving at 11 o'clock at night or something and showing up again at 7:30 in the morning. The first one's in, and I would usually go in and say, "Well, Gordo, what did you do last night?" And he said, well, I got home about 11:30. He lived in New Jersey, just over the bridge. And I got home last night and I was hungry. So I cooked myself a beautiful omelet with Gruyere cheese. And I ate it standing up at the sink with a bottle of Margaux. And so, and I'm like, did you drink the whole bottle? He goes, yeah. Wow. I mean, I wasn't going to leave the Margaux. I said, how was the omelet? He said, perfect. And so, everything is in the eye of the behold.
Well, in the few minutes that we have left, maybe we could take a taste of the Puy Fouissé. What I think has been the standout so far is the Verey Classé.
That's still the standout for me.
Is it?
Yeah. Me too. I mean,
I just like it better. It's just,
yeah, me too.
I like the Puy Fouissé. That's a good wine, but side by side. And if I wasn't drinking them side by side, I'd be very happy to drink
either
the Jadot Puy Fouissé.
But there's just more going on.
In the Puy Fouissé, I felt like there's a top and a middle, but there's no bottom note. It sort of falls
very
apart
yeah.
at the bottom. And that is not the case with the Verey Classé.
At the very beginning, the some wood in there, I thought, and some flavors of vanilla that you get often in Chardonnay wines that I thought were very pronounced.
Puy Fouissé, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But now, as I take another glass and start to taste it, those first impressions are sort of mellowing out. It's actually a good example of Puy Fouissé. Puy Fouissé is known, I believe, in Mâcon as one of the better quality wines, and they're often fairly powerful.
So is there any sort of summary that you might want to offer up in regard to an exploration of the Chardonnay grape in the Mâcon region?
The whole wines for me around the experience and you know, cook, live, and love. I think these wines lend themselves to big gatherings. The price point's so reasonable on these wines. The pleasure is at the top. Really lovely for convivial evenings of food and friends.
We want to thank you for joining us for this hour-long inquiry into the Mâcon region and the Chardonnay grape. This program is called What's My Wine? It's possible only because of the conviviality among Keith Zimmerman, Larry Burdick, Joe Canini, sitting around tasting wonderful food and drinking wonderful wines. My name is Cynthia Reeves, and this is WOOL 91.5 FM Radio. The music for What's My Wine was composed by Keith Zimmerman and arranged by T. Skoll, with Peter Stoley on accordion, Ashok Ajawal on bass, and Scott Shetler on clarinet, with Keith Zimmerman on guitar. This is a production of What's My Wine Radio out of Walpole, New Hampshire. Until the next wine, thank you for joining us.